Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins. For many North Carolinians who have moved to the state, the Scott family name may not be well known. But during the 20th century, the Scotts of Hall River in Alamance County dominated the state's politics and the Democratic Party that ruled the state. They did so by bringing a form of red-eye gravy progressivism to a state many considered ruled by a plutocracy. Much like the Longs of Louisiana, the Byrds of Virginia, and the Talmadges of Georgia during the same time period, three generations of Scotts, starting with Carr Scott and going through his son Robert and granddaughter Meg Scott Phipps, sought to hold political power in North Carolina, but that power was often their own undoing. Between the mid-20th century to the dawn of the new millennium, the dynamics of the Scott family represented the tensions of the state's political landscape, especially when it came to racial politics and the urban-rural divide. Longtime reporter, columnist, and observer of North Carolina politics for the Raleigh News and Observer, Rob Christensen, chronicles this family dynamic and the state's political metamorphosis from one-party rule to competitive politics in his new book, The Rise and Fall of the Branchhead Boys, North Carolina's Scott Family and the Era of Progressive Politics. This follows his first book, The Paradox of Tar Heel Politics, and both were published by UNC Press. Rob Christensen joins us from WUNC's Durham studios for the hour. Welcome back to Charlotte Talks, Rob.
Good morning.
Rob will be at Park Road Books on Thursday, June 6th at 7 p.m. You can find out more details at wfae.org/charlottetalks. You can also join our conversation on North Carolina politics. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. You can find us on Facebook or send us a tweet at Charlotte Talks. Rob, I want to start with, for those who aren't familiar with North Carolina of the 1930s and its politics, give us a brief overview of what the political landscape was like in the state when Carr Scott began his political career.
Well, first of all, I'm glad to be here, Michael. Thank you for having me. So this was an entirely different state from today. Some older North Carolinians, of course, will remember it, but it was a one-party state. The Democrats controlled everything. It was mainly controlled by the business communities in places like Charlotte and Winston-Salem and Durham, who made sure that they had a friendly Democratic governor in the governor's mansion and allies in the legislature. But the state was doing pretty well by the mid 20th century. There were cotton mills going up everywhere, and Charlotte was booming, and the furniture industry was booming, cigarette manufacturing was. So things were going well in the towns. They all had electricity and all the modern amenities. But that was not true for the countryside. And in fact, North Carolina at that time, rural North Carolinians were among the most isolated people in the country in terms of bad roads and lacking electricity and lacking telephones. And Carr Scott, who was elected agriculture commissioner, sought to have a pitchfork or populist revolt, essentially, against the ruling political machine. And his emphasis was on improving rural life. And so the state was much more rural then. Even places like Mecklenburg County, there were large parts of Mecklenburg County that were rural. I mean, that's where, you know, Billy Graham grew up on a farm in Mecklenburg County, right?
Right.
So like two-thirds of North Carolinians either lived in rural areas or areas that were designated as rural. And so I think the biggest city when Carr Scott was elected was Charlotte, was like 134,000. The places like the Research Triangle Park were nothing but barren pine woods and some rundown farms. And also the composition of North Carolina. This was before the Sun Belt growth And so the population was overwhelmingly native-born North Carolinians, unlike today. You just didn't have a lot of people from other parts of the country. And so Carscott, who was this rough, tobacco-chewing, cigar-smoking dairy farmer from Alamance County, essentially led a rural revolt against the political establishment. And that's what my book is about. The book is about is how, and this is confusing to people, how rural North Carolina really was the progressive cutting edge for a number of years in North Carolina, and why these progressive movements came about, and how they essentially collapsed. And by the time his son was being elected governor in the late 60s, and because of all the social ills and so forth.
Right. I want to get into that tension a little bit later. But what was Carscott's form of, you describe it as red-eye gravy progressivism. What programs were he advocating, was he advocating for rural North Carolina?
So the overwhelming number of rural roads were not paved back in the even the 1940s. And so he was pushing for a tremendous road building program. And people forget about how isolating it was to have a dirt road, because they would turn into mud and become almost impassable. Mm-hmm. And what did that mean? It wasn't just inconvenience. It often was a matter of life and death. So during long periods of when the weather was bad, you know, you couldn't get to the doctor. Or the doctor, this was still the age of when doctors made house visits, that doctor could not get to your house or your farm. And so one of the interesting things is going through all the Carscott papers is people telling these stories about how scared they were because their mother had a heart condition, or instances where their child died because they could not get them to the hospital, or people actually dying on the road, like in the Outer Banks. There were actually things where people, their cars or trucks would get stuck in the sand, and they'd have to, they have heart attacks trying to push the car out. Or there was a story of a letter about a Coast Guardsman who actually froze to death because he was stuck out in the roads at night and got so cold he froze to death. So it was a tremendous disadvantage to have these roads. And it came at a time when more and more children were being using school buses, because there was the days of the one-room schoolhouses were closing, and all these schools were consolidating. And so kids could no longer walk to school, and they had to take a school bus, and they were taking school buses over rural areas. But it's not just the roads. It was like electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like night and day, the life of between a city dweller in a place like Charlotte or Raleigh and versus somebody else living in the country, because you cannot imagine how difficult life was without electricity and how isolated it was. And the power companies were happy to run lines out to in Charlotte or Raleigh, but not so much in the countryside, because they couldn't make them pay, because you had to string them out over so many miles. Or if they did run them out, you had to sign a contract to buy a washing machine or a refrigerator before they would actually extend the line to make sure they could get their money out of it. And so, you know, you think about things like, even things that are like mundane things like wash day, clothes wash days for women. And in the days before electricity, they had to heat the water over, you know, often a primitive stove, a non-electric stove, and several times to wash and rinse, which they use lye soap, and then they have to hang it out, and then they have to heat the big old irons on these stoves and to get them hot, and they had to repeatedly do that to keep them hot. And so, I mean, life was just very, very difficult, and people aged before their time. Washing was an all-day ordeal. And then there were the telephones. So people in rural North Carolina had the fewest number of telephones of any state except for South Carolina by like 1945, I think it was. And so, things like There was one incident, for example, I think it was 1949, in Nash County, rural county located east of Raleigh, where, you know, you had a terrible school bus accident not too far from a school, and something like 7 children died. And there was no telephones anywhere nearby. Within 5 miles of that school, there was not a single telephone.
Wow.
And so, you know, some of the parents wrote a petition to the governor saying, look, maybe some of these kids' lives could have been saved if they had run telephone lines. You know, there was another person wrote, it was a professor at Appalachian State, but he was from Nash County, and his dad still ran the old farm, the old family place. And he was getting really old, but he still wanted to stay on the farm. And there was no way for the son, who was a college professor in Boone, North Carolina, to check up on his dad, who was living alone, to see if he was okay. So he had, because there wasn't a phone within 5 miles of where the farm was. And so he would have to actually get in his car and drive from Boone all the way to Nash County and back just every so often just to check up, make sure his dad was doing all right. I mean, that's the kind of isolation. Sometimes there would be they'd have electricity, but electricity was so bad that that you would go a couple hours every day without power. Or when you did get power, it would often be a power surge and would knock out your bulbs in a short matter of time, or would be so slow you couldn't get much generation. Things that are just, we think of maybe as third world now, but this was life in rural North Carolina. So when Carr Scott came into power, he was really talking about improving the lives of an isolated rural people. And these were mainly farmers of modest means. There were some rich farmers, but not that many. And there were a lot of them, because North Carolina had, as you know, one of the largest groups of farmers of any state in the country, like along with Texas. And so his agenda was what his neighbors said they wanted. And people, if you looked at to go through the files of Carr Scott's governorship, as I did, you find letter after letter demanding government activism. So we want the government to come in and pave the road near my farm. We want the government to come in and improve the school, which is rickety and falling down. We want the government to use its power to get the telephone companies or the electric utilities to run lines out. We've been waiting 20 years to get a telephone or some electricity out in our farm. Can't you do something? So it was a real sense of people, rural people, wanting governmental activism to improve their lives. And that's what Carr Scott did. And at the same time, we put this in a national context, a lot of these rural people were also supporting people like Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, and Harry Truman, his successor, who they supported that sort of activism.
Okay. In terms of he was first elected as agriculture commissioner and then decided to run for governor, but was told by the Shelby dynasty, a longtime political machine here in the state of North Carolina, to wait his turn. But he decided to buck the machine. We're coming up on a break in the next 30 seconds or so, but talk a little bit about that Shelby dynasty.
So the state had two big machines in the first part of the 20th century. First, the Simmons machine, and then the Shelby dynasty. It was led mainly by Governor O. Max Gardner, who was a textile mill owner and lawyer. And they were pretty moderate. They were not reactionaries, but they were very tied into the businesses in the major cities.
Let me pick up after the break. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
And welcome back to Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins. And we're talking with Rob Christensen on his newest book, The Rise and Fall of the Branch Head Boys and the Legacy of the Scott Family Dynasty on Progressive Politics in North Carolina. Rob will be at Park Road Books on Thursday, June 6th at 7 p.m. And you can find out more details at wfae.org/charlottetalks. Rob, I had to cut you off before the break about the political political machine that kind of ruled North Carolina. But Carr Scott decided when he was going to run for governor to go up against that machine. What was that dynamic like in terms of the battle between rural progressivism and the machine of North Carolina state politics?
So there was essentially a Democratic organization, and it was in every county, the courthouse crowd, essentially, and it pretty much controlled politics, and so they would line up who would be governor time after time again. They had a system which was an east-west rotation, so that the governor would be in the east and then next time be the west and then continuing like that. And so this is not a regressive group of people. These were fairly moderate. They helped build the University of North Carolina system into a good union system and so forth, but they were not paying enough attention to the rural areas. But the machine was actually running out of gas by 1948. Okay. It no longer had the same amount of power. The guy who was heading it was Omax Gardner, and he had just died. He had been named by Truman to be U.S. ambassador to Great Britain, and just on the day before he was to set sail, he died of a heart attack. And the guy who was supposed to be the next governor in 1948, William Unstead, instead was appointed to fill a Senate seat. And so Charlie Johnson, who was the state treasurer from down in the eastern part of the state, was the stand-in for the machine. And he looked like a governor out of central casting. He was a very distinguished-looking fella and so forth. But he didn't have much charisma. He was very dry. And Carr Scott had traveled the state in part because he was agriculture commissioner. Mm-hmm. But before that, he was head of the state grange. And people forget about how important the state grange was as a progressive force in North Carolina. And so he knew the back roads and he knew the needs. He knew that Charlie Johnson was a tempting target to try to defeat. And so what Carr did was he built a political base that was outside the machine. And okay. So he knew all the lawyers in the state were against him, all the Democratic politicians, all the courthouse rings were against him. And so he went out to the countryside and got in campaign and got his support outside the political organizations. Hence the name Branchhead Boys. Branchhead Boys.
Meaning what?
Meaning the people who people who lived at the head of the tributaries or out in the country. And so he would say he would get all his support from the Branchhead Boys, all the people who lived out in the rural areas at the head of the tributaries. And by the time he got to the county seat, he had his votes. He didn't need the courthouse. He didn't need all the judges and the courthouse politicians. And that's how he got elected. And it was one of the biggest upsets in North Carolina political history, without a doubt.
When he became governor, he put forward a program called Go Forward. And much of it was almost, it reads like it was a challenge from the legislature in regards to what they wanted versus what Governor Scott wanted. Talk about the dynamic of that. Even though they were both controlled by the Democratic Party, it seemed like it was two opposition parties, one in the governor's mansion, one in the legislature.
So this was a one-party state. There were Republicans, particularly in the western part of the state, but they were in a distinct minority. And, of course, African-Americans were essentially – there were only a few African-Americans who were registered to vote at that time, mainly in the cities and towns. They mainly were denied voting in the rural areas. But so the Democrats ruled the roost. But so everybody of all political philosophies just about was a Democrat. So if you were a conservative, you're a Democrat. If you're a moderate, you're a Democrat. If you're a liberal, you're a Democrat. So you had various wings of the Democratic Party, which essentially functioned as today's Democrat and Republican parties. And so the legislature was all part of the political machine, and they all backed Carr Scott's opponent, State Treasurer Charlie Johnson, in the 1948 election. And they did not want him to see him succeed, and they thought his proposals were way too expensive. So, I mean, Carr Scott was proposing, huge bond issues and raising taxes and doing all these things and putting a lot of the energies in rural areas as opposed to the cities and towns. So a lot of Carscott's opposition came from places like Charlotte. For example, his road, he had a $200 million road bond issue. It was all going to rural areas. None of it was going to Charlotte or Raleigh. And so he had to fight essentially an opposing political party that were still Democrats. And the way he did it was he went over the heads and was one of the first politicians to go over the heads of the of the legislature and local political bosses. And he used radio. This is the age before TV. He would make all these radio addresses. He would call farmers in for big rallies into Raleigh to show their political strength. And suddenly you had thousands of farmers showing up, you know, in their overalls and so forth, demanding better services in the rural areas. And it really, you know, it got a lot of attention in the legislature.
Yeah.
And he was among the first to do that. And he would call out the legislature. He was not very diplomatic, and he would call out lobbyists by name who were working against him and attack them, and he would call out the legislators and attack them, and so he made a lot of enemies that way, but he was able to bulldoze his program through.
And he not only battled with the legislature, but it seemed like he would battle with his own party. He had a fateful choice as governor when in 1950 U.S. Senator Melville Broughton died. Carscott, as the governor, had the opportunity to appoint a replacement, and he settled on the president of the University of North Carolina, Frank Porter Graham, which turned out to be a controversial choice. Conservatives were angry at Graham's appointment, and they sought one of the candidacy of their own, Willis Smith, who sought to use the issues of Reds and race in the Democratic nomination battle. Talk a little bit about that U.S. Senate battle between Graham and Smith, but really Carscott's role in that.
So Carscott, it was, you're exactly right, Michael, it was a highly controversial appointment to appoint UNC President Frank Porter Graham. Frank Porter Graham had helped make the UNC one of the finest universities in the country, but he was also a liberal activist. So he signed all these petitions for labor unions and other groups. And he, in fact, is arguably Frank Porter Graham was the biggest liberal in the South at that particular time. And so it was a shocker, and drew lots of national attention when he named Frank Porter Graham. The question is whether Graham could get elected once he had to face the voters after his appointment. And so the campaign, the 1950 Senate Democratic primary between conservative Willis Smith and liberal Frank Porter Graham was many regard as probably the nastiest political race we've ever had in North Carolina. We've had a lot of them.
More so than the Helms-Hunt races?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
And it was unbelievably nasty, and the conservatives first pointed at, essentially said he was a, they didn't say he was a communist, but they said he was essentially a dupe. He was a pinko. He was a dupe of the communist. And then they used the race issue. And Frank Porter Graham led the first primary, but things changed in the runoff because things were happening nationally. The Supreme Court came down with some very key cases that were began to knock down the walls of segregation. So things like I think Oklahoma, whether they had to provide graduate programs for African American students. And so the court ruled that they did, and I think there were some rulings regarding railroad cars and that sort of thing. And so the Supreme Court, even though we still in the age of segregation, was beginning to chip away at the walls of segregation, and that caused panic essentially across the South, and that had a tremendous role in terms of helping defeat Frank Porter Graham. And in fact, it was one way to look at this is that there was a window, post-World War II window, for more progressive politics in the South. And that's when Carr Scott was elected, and some other progressives were elected too, people like Lyndon Johnson in Texas and so forth. And that, but that window began closing after after you began getting these decisions on that began chipping away at the segregation laws, and voters in not only North Carolina but all across the South began retreating to a more conservative, safer brand of politician who would uphold the color line.
And you talk about this in the book. You write that this rural progressivism was confronted by a deeply ingrained conservatism, much of it emanating from those same fields and church pews in rural North Carolina. Do we see that continuing in today's political dynamics, what Carr Scott dealt with in the mid-20th century?
Well, we do. And so so what began happening, and we sort of moved things ahead of time. I may be getting ahead of myself here, but the race issue began playing out in a major way. But particularly by the time his son Bob Scott came along, you had the. And this is a statistic that just stuns me, is that during Bob Scott, who was elected, his son who was elected in 1968, when he was his first 6 months in office, he called out the National Guard 9 times for civil disturbances. 9 times. Now, today, if a governor called out the National Guard for a civil disturbance once, it would probably be the major event of his administration. But 9 times in the first 6 months. Yeah. So you had your campuses were uproar over the Vietnam War, and you had. You had school integration coming in, which was much more difficult than a lot of people remember, and then you had some other factors going on too. And so essentially, a lot of these people who were voting for Carr Scott before because he was trying to improve their lives, they began voting for candidates who voiced their were closer to their views on things like race.
It seems like Bob Scott, Carr Scott's son, when he was running in 68, had a very difficult campaign strategy to try and make a deal between the two sides of a very biracial coalition that Democrats were seeing. Blacks were becoming more engaged. They were voting more, while Republicans seemed to be building the infrastructure and a competitiveness, but they had to deal with the appeal of a George Wallace presidential campaign in 68. How did Bob Scott continue his father's legacy of trying to promote that rural progressivism, or was that waning and going out the door?
So there were a number of things going on here, and it wasn't just race. So there a lot of time, 20 years later, when the son was running for governor, first of all, there were far fewer farmers, okay? So some of that base was going away. And many of those farmers were better off now. They were not many as poor. And the state was better off. So the people were, the economic income was had climbed considerably by the time he was coming along. This was still before the big Sun Belt growth era, but still the state was improving. So so Bob Scott had to try to be all things to all people, which is what you essentially referenced. And he had to keep together a coalition of these rural conservatives and then African Americans and labor, and it was a very difficult balancing act. And so, for example, in the 68 campaign, you had a three-part presidential race: Richard Nixon, George Wallace as an independent candidate, and Hubert Humphrey as a Democrat. And Hubert Humphrey came in third in the state, and there was a huge number of George Wallace supporters out there. And so, both Bob Scott and his Republican opponent, former Republican Congressman Jim Garner at that time, who was kind of the presaged Jesse Helms, were the Wallace vote was and the polls show were equally divided between the two of them. So they both had to go out and court George Wallace supporters, and at the same time while trying to hold black voters in the coalition. Mm-hmm. So it was an extremely difficult thing. And he ended up making everybody unhappy in some ways, but it wasn't enough to squeak through.
And he certainly, once he was elected, had to deal, like you said, with campus unrest. He also had to deal with the issue of busing, and particularly a U.S. Supreme Court case coming out of Charlotte Mecklenburg school system. What was the reaction to the issue of integration of the school systems using busing, and how did Governor Bob Scott have to deal with that?
So it's interesting, if you read through the papers of Carr Scott, you have all these people writing in saying, asking for an activist government for all the things we just talked about. Mm-hmm. When you look at Bob Scott, the letters to Bob Scott, things have totally turned around. And there it was, the voters and constituents of Bob Scott were saying, keep the government off my back. And a lot of it was driven by school integration issue. North Carolina was not considered a hard-line anti-integration state like some of the more deep South states, but it still had prevented most schools from being significantly integrated by the time Scott came on. And so it came in a couple waves. The first waves were court orders in places like Eastern North Carolina, where you had large black populations in rural places, and those schools were being ordered integrated, and it was just a mind-bending for a lot of white people. And you say, well, it's racist, but it was also, you know, if you read some of the letters, they're not openly racist. It's something that it's just something they have never ever thought they would confront.
Right.
And so it was a very difficult thing. And then you had In the larger towns and cities, you had the question of not deliberate plan of segregation, but the way that it was through housing patterns, and housing was very segregated at the time.
Okay. We're going to pick up our conversation with Rob Christensen after this break. We're talking about the rise and fall of the Branchhead Boys and the legacy of the Scott family here in North Carolina politics. We'll be right back after this break. This is Charlotte Talks. This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, sitting in for Mike Collins, and we're talking about the family dynasty of the Scotts in North Carolina politics with Rob Christensen and his new book, The Rise and Fall of the Branchhead Boys. We were talking about the governorship of Bob Scott, the son of Carr Scott, and it ended. His governorship ended with the election of the first Republican to win the North Carolina executive office since the late 1800s, and that was Jim Holzhauser. But there was another important Republican who would turn this idea of rural populism into kind of a core message for the Republican Party, and that was Jesse Helms. Talk a little bit about the impact that, I know you mentioned Jesse Helms a lot in the book, about the Scots, but what role did Jesse Helms play in creating the modern Republican Party for North Carolina?
So Jesse Helms played a very important role, and he did that in part through his TV program. He was one of the first TV editorialists in the country, and it was in station WRL and located in Raleigh. And during the 60s, essentially, which was a tumultuous decade with school integration and campus riots and the Vietnam War and everything, all that, it was just that was just the sort of stuff that just played right into Jesse Helms and his ability to talk about the discontent with some of these trends with his conservative voters. And he went, it was not only in Raleigh, but it went all his voice carried through all throughout Eastern North Carolina. And he had a syndicated column. And so he was able to really plug into that discontent that was going on. And so this populism, people, is hard to define sometimes, but mm-hmm. it's the little man against the big impersonal forces. And in Carr Scott today, populism was was pushing big business to run the power lines out and to put more things in the countryside, and standing up to the corporate interests, essentially, or the oil companies and so forth. But by the time Jesse Helms came around, and Jesse Helms was he was the first reporter, newspaper and radio reporter covering Carr Scott. And he admired Carr Scott, actually, at the very beginning. And there's one letter in there that he's urging Carr Scott to think about running for president. But Jesse was able to take that same populism that Carr Scott and tap it in and change it. And so his populism, though, wasn't against big business, because actually Jesse Helms was very much in favor of business and untrammeled free enterprise sort of philosophy. But he was able to make the big impersonal forces that he campaigned against, the federal government trying to integrate your schools or tell you how to live, or you know, United Nations, or mm-hmm. Or the big news media. He was, you know, if to go to a Jesse Helms rally in the 1970s, 1980s, was very much like going to a Donald Trump rally today. I mean, he was very much attacking the press, often individually.
And you were individually attacked. I mean, before the Trump rallies, to remember that Jesse Helms and the Republicans went after you as a reporter.
So going to Trump rally felt like a deja vu. So, you know, I can remember, for example, there was one rally in Goldsboro at a big tobacco warehouse. Tobacco warehouses were the biggest auditorium or space to hold an event in a lot of these small towns. And so Jesse Helms was going preaching against the big news media and how they were ruining the country. And he had like a laundry list of things of how the news media was ruining the country. And he finished his litany by looking at me and pointing his finger and says, as represented by Rob Christensen, who's sitting right there. And I had with me at that time Peter Boyer, who was a big-time New York Magazine writer. And he sort of jerks up in his seat when Helms does that, and he looks at me and looks around. He says, you know, that'd be scary if this crowd wasn't so damn old. So.
Wow. Okay. The third member of the Scott family to seek political office was Bob Scott's daughter, Meg Scott Phipps, and she tried to recreate the family's entry into politics for her generation by campaigning for agriculture commissioner. She actually defeated the now current commissioner, Steve Troxler, but there were issues that plagued her campaign and eventual time as commissioner. What were they?
So her basic problem grew out of her election and the breaking of campaign finance law. So North Carolina is one of the few states where the agriculture commissioner is actually elected as opposed to appointed. In a lot of states, that's an appointed department. And so it's very the old days when you have of political machines. You know, as long as all you had to do is get the approval of the political bosses, and you were elected. But it's not true today, because the political machines are essentially gone. And so you have to raise lots and lots of money. And who cares about who agriculture commissioner is? Well, mainly it's people being regulated by the agriculture commissioner's office. But, you know, you can get some money from some of your friends, and from, if you're a Democrat loyalist, or Republican right. loyalist. But mainly it's people regulating. And so one of the big sources of money was this people who controlled the amusements at the state fair. Now, that may not sound like much, but the state fair, North Carolina has one of the biggest state fairs in the country. You know, you get 1 million people showing up.
It's a huge deal. Yeah.
Yeah. And those amusements, they get the franchise for that, is actually very big business. And the amusement people, the carny people, as you might say, deal in cash. And so there was a lot of cash that was floating around, and not just to make Scott Fisk, but to other candidates as well. And some of it was illegal. And so, you know, the Scotts were never particularly – they came up in a different era,
mm-hmm.
Carr Scott and Bob Scott. They came up in the era where There weren't all these campaign finance laws. There wasn't investigative reporting. Federal prosecutors generally didn't go after essentially some of these petty things. And so she was operating in part with the advice of her father, former Governor Bob Scott, and in the old way. And she hadn't got the memo that you can't do that any longer. And all this cash was flowing around. And she was undone by it. Now, she probably didn't do anything that her father hadn't done or her grandfather hadn't done.
Yeah.
But you just can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
And she got caught up with it and was convicted and served some time in federal prison because of it. And it was, of course, a very, very sad ending to the story.
Right. In the last couple of minutes, you wrote in your previous book, The Paradox of Tar Heel Politics, that the story of North Carolina's politics is nuanced, multi-layered, and at times contradictory. And two of the critical issues that the Scott family faced in the state's politics were the divides based on race and region, especially the urban-rural divide. Give me your sense of what these two divides, how are they still influencing the state's politics today? You're a longtime observer of it. Is race and regionalism still as prevalent in the state's politics as they were when Carr Scott ran?
Well, so we've come a long way in race. So mm-hmm. Let's start with that. I mean, so the state went in 2008 for Barack Obama, and that would never have happened a generation earlier. So you have to keep in perspective. We've come a very long way, but race still is a powerful force. I can remember the advice that Bill Snyder, who was a longtime political columnist for the Greensboro News Record, gave. This was back in the 70s. He told political reporters. He says, you'll be tempted from time to time to write that race is no longer matters. He says, here's my advice. Don't do it.
Really?
And so it's still there. It's, there's a couple of political scientists who did a study, and their conclusion was that, there really, since 1960, there have been two major forces in American politics, not just Southern politics, North Carolina politics, mm-hmm. national politics, the civil rights revolution and the counter-revolution.
Yeah.
And so that's still – and in terms of regionalism, so the urban-rural divide has not gone away. It's actually as big as it's ever been. Half the counties in the state have lost population in recent years. And so the problem now, of course, is not that they need electricity or telephones or the roads paved, but they still do need things like the internet access and better schools and better health care and lots of other things. But it's interesting is that the politics has so much changed. So there's still tremendous needs. I mean, the places like Raleigh and Charlotte and Durham and Greensboro, they really don't – people living there really don't need an activist government because those economies are going along pretty well on mm-hmm. their own. So a conservative government works pretty well in those areas. But that's not so for the rural areas. And yet today – the most conservative areas are the rural areas, and so you have the group of political leaders who are representing rural North Carolina who are the least likely to support government activism. So there's a disconnect there.
And I was thinking in the broad terms, could a new rural progressivism play out in today's North Carolina politics, or have the descendants of the Branchhead Boys become so enamored with the Jesse Helms brand of keep government off of our backs, even if they're trying to help?
So there certainly, I think, is some support for doing more things than Royer. And so I think you can talk to people about how to improve rural life and using government in some instances to do that. But there's a couple things that have been going on. One is that we're no longer a state dominated by small farmers. We have less than 50,000 farms, and at the head of when Carr Scott was governor, we had 300,000. And a lot of those farmers are now pretty prosperous. They're big farmers, and the state is no longer the poor state it once was. It's not a rich state, but it's like getting close to the national average. It's still below, but And so it's not the same state economically. And then things like religion, as I think, are important. So Carr Scott and the Scott clan used religion as sort of an ally. You know, it's God wants us to improve the schools and make life better. And they were very active. They were active church people. And he would often talk about when he wanted a road improvements, we need to get people so people can get to church, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But we saw the politics of a lot of people with religious sensibilities change in time because of abortion and school prayer and because of some of these social changes that people were reluctant to accept, whether, you know, it was gays or transgender, that sort of thing. And so religion has become more of a force for conservatives, Republicans, in a way that it was not when Carr Scott was coming along.
Okay. In the last couple of minutes here that we've got in the show, what surprised you the most in writing this book? You have observed North Carolina politics for a long time. What surprised you when you were writing this book?
So I knew the basic outlines because I'd already written a book about North Carolina politics, paradoxical politics. So I knew the general outlines. I would say a couple things. One, I was surprised at how powerful the rural progressivism was and the political movements that were behind it. We really didn't talk about that, but and so the extent of the isolation of people, and then I was also surprised at just how the turmoil we had in the late 60s and early 70s. I mean, we didn't have things like Watts or Detroit or Newark, but we had blow-ups everywhere. And it was an incredibly difficult time, much more difficult than I think a lot of people remember. And I write about that during those events as well.
Mm-hmm. And particularly we had university buildings being taken over by students. Particularly I remember reading in the book about, I think it was NCA&T, that there were building takeovers by the students during Bob Scott's tenure.
Well, one of the worst events, and people have forgotten that, is North Carolina A&T. It happened about 50 years ago, and where there was gunfire and so forth and protest. And so Scott sent in 500 National Guardsmen with their guns blazing to take a dormitory in an American campus, mm-hmm. with helicopters and planes flying over, laying down tear gas. And they fired off hundreds of bullets. I mean, you could go in and count the bullet holes in the dormitory. And to think about that today, about an armed military assault, and they had armored cars and everything, right, on an American campus, is just it's just mind-boggling.
Do you think we'll ever see a family dynasty like the Scott family in North Carolina politics in the future?
Well, it's very difficult. I won't say never, because it never is a long time, but it's a very difficult thing, and the Scott's going to keep it going for so long.
Right. Okay. That is Rob Christensen, a longtime columnist and reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer, talking about his new book, The Rise and Fall of the Branchhead Boys, North Carolina's Scott Family and the Era of Progressive Politics. Rob will be at Park Roads Books on Thursday, June 6th at 7 p.m. to talk about his new book. Rob, thank you very much for the hour.
I enjoyed it.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.